What we're asking Matt here to do is a holy thing.
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Don't you blaspheme in here. Don't you blaspheme in here. Now, this is my man. This is my restaurant. And you two are going to just walk right out that door without your dry white toast, without your faux fried chickens, and without Matt Guitar Murphy.
Now, you listen to me. I love you, but I'm the man and you are the woman, and I'll make the decisions concerning my life.
You better think about what you're saying. You better think about the consequences of your actions.
You are listening to the Night and Day podcast, featuring the interview archives of Western New York music writer Tom Jennings. Tom has interviewed some of the biggest names in music and entertainment, and now you can enjoy these never-before-heard interviews. Here's your host, Tom Jennings.
Welcome to another edition of Night and Day. I'm Tom Jennings, your host. You know, when I originally started this podcast, I did it to share some interviews with artists that had recently passed away. And, you know, over the years, I've done a lot of interviews, but there's one that's always kind of risen to the top. And this will be the first time that I'm able to share it with anyone. I mean, I probably could have shared it before, but the timing now, of course, with the passing of Aretha Franklin, I went back in the archives and looked around, and I knew that I'd interviewed Aretha. I hadn't really thought much about the interview. A friend of mine, Peggy Berenger, posted something on Facebook, a link back to the original article. And, you know, it brought back some great memories. I mean, Aretha was coming to Niagara Falls. She was just coming off of an extended illness. And I had done a little bit of prep work to talk with her. I knew it was going to be a short interview, which this one runs about 15 minutes, but I wanted to touch base with her on her time in Buffalo, New York. And I mean, as you can hear, it's kind of interesting talking with her about Buffalo. Is like, you know, it's like a walk down memory lane for her. She also talks a little bit about the civil rights movement, some other things, but just, you know, I don't need to tell you that Aretha Franklin was not only just a legendary musician, she was just an iconic leader, civil rights leader, leader of, you know, really an example of a woman who really had to overcome a lot of things to succeed in her career. And by all accounts, a savvy businesswoman as well. So for sure, Aretha Franklin's going to be missed. And I know you don't want to listen to me talk, especially if you're an Aretha Franklin fan. So we'll give you this 15 minutes with Aretha Franklin. This is, I believe, 2012.
I can't even begin to tell you how honored I am to be speaking to you right now.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you so much.
The first question I'd like to ask, I mean, I didn't know if you know, I'm running for a paper in the Niagara Falls, New York area, which is about 20 miles from Buffalo. And I was doing a little internet research, and legend has it that your very first public performance was singing at the Friendship Missionary Baptist Church in Buffalo, where your father was a minister. Is that true, first of all? And second of all, do you remember that, singing there for the first time in public?
I do not remember that. I do remember, of course, being at the church and sitting in the balcony and in different other places where I sat. But I don't recall singing at Friendship. My father, of course, pastored there for a number of years, and then we moved to Detroit from Buffalo. But I used to ride the King's Highway to Buffalo every summer and come to visit my mom.
Well, so you have a lot of fond memories of the Buffalo area, then?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. She lived out, and we lived out in Cold Springs on Life, and of course, I would get my Texas Red Hots all the time, each time I came to Buffalo, and I stayed on Glenwood at one point as a very young girl when my dad was pastoring at Friendship, and my mother was a nurse at the Buffalo General Hospital.
Wow. So, yeah, in fact, that house it's 179 Glenwood Avenue, I was just pulling it up on Google Maps, and it's still there today.
Really? Yeah. Really? How did you do that?
Well, I was digging around. I found the history of the church, and they listed where the parsonage was, and I pulled it up on Google Maps, and there was the house. I looked at it, and it looks like somebody's taken real good care of it and renovated it. I was kind of surprised that we don't have some kind of historic marker there, marking the fact that you guys lived there at one point.
Now, that is fabulous, because I was thinking of Glenwood, and we were going to come over to Buffalo before the concert or after the concert and drive around. And I said, but I don't remember the address. I don't remember the address. I know I have an idea of where the house is, but I don't remember the address. And voila, you gave it to me, 179, all right.
Yep, there's like a Queen City Cooperative that's a couple doors up from there, which I thought was kind of neat, because, you know, you're the queen of soul.
Uh-huh.
So
fabulous. That is fabulous. And 179. Okay, I'm writing that down right now.
That's great. And February is Black History Month, of course, and you know, you, which is just such an important part of the you know, the African American civil rights movement, and you had early on had contacts with Martin Luther King Jr. You sang at a concert that he attended just a couple months before he passed away, and I believe you sang at his funeral as well. Would you mind just sharing some reflections on Martin Luther King Jr. from the man you know, and then now looking back, the legacy of Martin Luther King and what he has meant to this country?
Well, Dr. King, to begin with, was a family friend. He was a very close friend of my dad's, Reverend C.L. Franklin. And, of course, he was not only the great civil rights leader that he was, but one of the great orators, I believe, of our time. And the things that he stood for, I think, had a very, very profound effect on the country. And I'm just pleased to have known and met him and had the opportunity to speak to him up close and to have gone on some of the very early concerts that he went out on, the different concerts that he had and services that he had in different cities in the very early days. And those were the days that prior to Harry Belafonte and Lena Horne and Sidney Poitier and different other people who came out to support the movement. But indeed a great man.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I was watching a documentary about you the other day, and I guess people don't really think about this, but early on in your career, you and other African-American performers couldn't stay in the same hotels as white entertainers at the time. And that's just almost unfathomable in this day and age.
Sure, in the early days, there were things like that traveling south. We traveled by car, and there were different restaurants, of course, where you could not eat. And we usually went to the grocery store and bought a lot of groceries. But there were gas stations where you also could not get gas. Gulf, during that time, was very, very big. And you could use their restrooms. They were very clean and things like that. But we always stopped at Gulf. The other stations sometimes were a problem.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And musically,
yeah.
I mean, your career has, I don't even know where to begin, but if we could talk about some of the great producers that you've worked with, and maybe the importance of a producer sometimes is overlooked, but the three that come to mind would Jerry Wexler, of course, Quincy Jones, and Narada Michael Walden, all at different points in your career. What did they get out of you, each one of those individually, that helped make you a better performer? Because they all say that you were amazing to work with in the studio.
Well, I appreciate that. And they were all great producers, as well as just really great and cool people, very positive people. and a lot of fun, especially Luther. Luther was really one, a great humorous. I always say he did and he didn't miss his calling, because he certainly didn't miss his singing, but he did miss it in terms of his sense of humor. He was really, really funny. And he could have you bending over, holding your sides. He was so funny. But I enjoyed working with all of them, and usually they just let me go in the studio and just do what I did best, which was just sing. Luther was particular on phrasing sometimes, or she would check your enunciation and things like that, just to be sure everything was crystal clear. That pretty much was it.
One of my favorite movies of all time, The Blues Brothers, and your scene is iconic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when you were originally approached to be a part of that film? And I mean, it was the first motion picture that you were actually cast in.
Yes, it was. I got a call from an agent saying that John Landis wanted to speak to me about doing something with Belushi and Aykroyd. And, of course, I got together and said, absolutely. And the only thing that I really didn't like about doing the movie was having to be up at 7 o'clock in the morning. That was the only thing I really didn't like about it. Otherwise, I had fun with them. That pretty much was it. Once you got up and once you got your makeup and all of that on, then everything was great. It was the getting up and getting there that was kind of hard on you, because I just wasn't used to being up at that time of morning, and I'm more of a night person, and it just wasn't my time of morning to be up. But once I got up, everything was cool.
Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of pizzazz in that performance. You had some great lines in there, so it's surprising to hear that you were even the slightest bit tired.
Thank you. We had a good time.
And speaking of performances, and I apologize if I slaughter the name.
Just a minute. Sorry.
Nason Dorma, the operatic piece that you performed at the Grammy Awards, to me, just one of the greatest musical moments in history. Certainly, in the Grammy Awards.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know what your emotions were, but I think many people watching that, knowing the situation with Pavarotti at the time, but just the performance, it's just stunning. And I'm not an opera person. I guess two questions. How did you get into singing opera? And secondarily, that particular performance, was it really as they said that they just called you and you said, yeah, absolutely, I'll do it right away?
No, about 3 weeks before the Grammys, Music Care was paying tribute to and lauded Mr. Pavarotti. And so I sung for him at the, Park Avenue, the hotel there. I'll mention it before I hang up. I just can't think of it right now. And so I sung for the Music Care performance for him. So I had rehearsed with my classical... just a moment, please. Hold on.
Oh, no problem.
With my classical coach. And we worked on Nessun Dorma. And... are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. And, so I really crammed to know it by the time I had to know it. And then once I had sung it for him and met him and all, I just kind of forgot about it, because I wasn't going to include it in my repertoire. I hadn't planned to include it in the repertoire or anything. And then went on to the Grammys, and at the very last minute, the producers came up and told me what was happening with Mr. Pavarotti, and could I sing it again? Like, whoa, I've got to try and recall it all now. So I just kind of lightly panicked for a minute, but I pulled it back together.
Yeah, it's... I mean, even... I think it's been 12 or 13 years. Just watching on YouTube, it's just still such a stunning performance. And considering that it's not even in your native language, that's what makes it mm-hmm. even that much more remarkable.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And another legendary performance, you know, I'm a rock guy, and I mean, you were the first female inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Those Fillmore mm-hmm. West shows in 1971 just came out in box set form not too long ago, the whole set of all of them. Did you get a chance to listen to those again? Because those, again, extraordinary performances, and what a great piece from your history.
I do, and I really do love going back to those moments, and I sit with my things and play them all. I go all the way back to the beginning. So, yes, I do enjoy it very, very much, bringing those, reliving those moments and going back to exactly what was happening at the time.
And I've got time for a couple quick questions. The first one will be...
Okay.
When you originally did the song Respect, which is now a signature song, obviously, the mm-hmm. the difference between the arrangement of the Otis Redding version and your version is, I mean, it's pretty significant. Did Otis Redding ever express any reservation on that, or was that just something that was fairly acceptable back at the time?
No, I think he enjoyed it. I think he liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. That is it.
And you definitely added some very interesting elements to it.
Yeah, my sister and I, Carolyn, worked on the background. And at that time, you know, Laugh In was very, very big in the country. And they had that Sock It To Me line. They just took that Sock It To Me line, where it used to be a neighborhood colloquialism. It'd be